I want to read for you some comments that we got from listeners, and we're getting a lot of them, Jerusha. Shannon tweeted, here's one suggestion for homeschooling. Ban it outright. There might be some legitimate reasons for homeschooling, but most of it is done to brainwash kids with religion or politics or bigotry. And here's another tweet we got from Church of Baseball. Religious extremism is a plague on our society, and homeschoolers are largely fundamentalists who want to keep their kids out of society and in their tiny warped bubbles. What do you think about this conception of homeschooling, Jerusha, that it's isolationist and it's for parents who want to sequester their kids?
Well, I think there are many different kinds of homeschooling, and it's a mistake to throw it all in one bag. But I will say that education is not every homeschool parent's priority.
Mm-hmm. In other words, indoctrination is.
It could be.
Or
they
sequestration.
Might be trying to create a certain kind of family, or there's too much cover for parents that have other intentions that are using the lack of regulation to conceal abuse or neglect.
Now, what regulations are there around homeschooling in your home state of Kansas?
In Kansas, we have no rules.
No
we don't
rules.
Even count how many kids are being homeschooled in Kansas. The state has no idea. That's partly what terrified me as I started homeschooling my kids. For 6 years, nobody ever contacted me. No one ever checked to see if I had a curriculum. Kids could be unsupervised, left teaching themselves. They could be working for the family business. Nobody would ever check.
All the kids have to do is not show up.
Singing old church hymns and nursery rhymes from the days way back before my time. With the little child upon my knee, singing every sweet word back to me. Look how far I had to come to get back where I started from. With a child's wisdom passing time, singing old church hymns and nursery rhymes.
Everybody, welcome back to School Sucks. This is Brett. I'm the guy who listens to NPR podcasts, so you don't have to. We'll get to that shortly. This week, we are going to be revisiting, apparently, the original book of anti-homeschooling hymns. And I have a great guest, a long overdue guest, today and back again on Wednesday for this project. His name is Corey DeAngelis. He is the director of school choice at the Reason Foundation, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and the executive director at the Educational Freedom Institute. So I've been meaning to have Corey on the show for quite some time. I was keeping this in my back pocket for the right occasion. The right occasion arrived a week ago. Around that time, people started sharing an article with me from Harvard Magazine, published in their spring edition of this year. It is called The Risks of Homeschooling. I read this article late last week, and it began an adventure all the way to a so-called academic paper called Homeschooling: Parent Rights Absolutism versus Child Rights to Education and Protection. Ooh, you can only have one. Choose wisely. It is written by a Harvard law professor named Elizabeth Barthollet. These readings, along with my following of people like Corey and Kerry McDonald, also pointed me to an upcoming summit at Harvard University. It's called the Homeschooling Summit: Problems, Politics, and Prospects for Reform. And what I was suggesting there at the very beginning of the show with that clip is just from some NPR podcast. I mean, what do you care what a couple of NPR listeners tweet? Well, these ideas start with academics and papers like the one we're going to be talking about in Wednesday's episode. It appeared in the Arizona Law Review at the end of last year. The conclusions in papers like this one are passed along to policymakers, but also to everybody else. And eventually it is what becomes known as public opinion. And now is a time, of course, where it would be most unfortunate if the public opinion was generally negative towards the idea of alternative education or learning outside of school, where, in case I haven't said this already, learning actually takes place for the most part. Now, I'm sure there's a few thousand people in this audience who have not read this article yet, The Risks of Homeschooling from Harvard Magazine, so I am about to torture you by reading it in its entirety. If you are driving, I recommend you pull over. If you are holding a hammer for any reason, I recommend you put it down. Let's begin The Risks of Homeschooling by Erin O'Donnell from the May-June issue of Harvard Magazine. A rapidly increasing number of American families are opting out of sending their children to school, choosing instead to educate them at home. Homeschooled kids now account for roughly 3% to 4% of the school-age population in the United States, a number equivalent to those attending charter schools and larger than the number currently attending parochial schools. Yet Elizabeth Barthollet, Wasserstein Public Interest Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Law School's Child Advocacy Program, sees risks for children and society in homeschooling and recommends a presumptive ban on the practice. Homeschooling, she says, not only violates children's rights to a, quote, meaningful education and their right to be protected from potential child abuse, but may keep them from contributing positively to a democratic society. Quote, we have an essentially unregulated regime in the area of homeschooling, Barthollet asserts. All 50 states have laws that make education compulsory, and state constitutions ensure a right to education. Quoting again, but if you look at the legal regime governing homeschooling, there are very few requirements that parents do anything, unquote. Even apparent requirements such as submitting curricula or providing evidence that teaching and learning are taking place, she says, aren't necessarily enforced. Only about a dozen states have rules about the level of education needed by parents who homeschool, she adds. Quote, that means effectively that people can homeschool who've never gone to school themselves, who don't even read or write themselves, unquote. In another handful of states, parents are not required to register their children as homeschooled. They can simply keep their kids at home. This practice, Barthollet says, can isolate children. She argues that one benefit of sending children to school at age 4 or 5 is that teachers are, quote, mandated reporters, required to alert authorities to evidence of child abuse or neglect. Quote, teachers and other school personnel constitute the largest percentage of people who report to Child Protective Services, she explains, whereas not one of the 50 states requires that homeschooling parents be checked for prior reports of child abuse. Even those convicted of child abuse, she adds, could still just decide, quote, I'm going to take my kids out of school and keep them at home, unquote. As an example, she points to the memoir Educated by Tara Westover, the daughter of Idaho survivalists who never sent their children to school. Although Westover learned to read, she writes that she received no other formal education at home, but instead spent her teenage years working in her father's scrap business, where severe injuries were common, and endured abuse by her older brother. Barthollet doesn't see this book as an isolated case of a family that slipped through the cracks. Quote, that's what can happen under the system in effect in most of the nation. Oh, you hear that, everyone out there with an understaffed scrapyard? Continuing on, in a paper published recently in the Arizona Law Review, she notes that parents choose homeschooling for an array of reasons. Some find local schools lacking or want to protect their children from bullying. Others do it to give their children the flexibility to pursue sports or other activities at a high level. But surveys of homeschoolers show that a majority of such families, by some estimates up to 90%, we're going to be talking about all the problems with little clauses like that, by some estimates up to 90%. Such families are driven by conservative Christian beliefs and seek to remove their children from mainstream culture. Barthollet notes that some of these parents are extreme religious ideologues who question science and promote female subservience and white supremacy. She views the absence of regulations ensuring that homeschooled children receive a meaningful education equivalent to that required in public schools as a threat to U.S. democracy. Quote, from the beginning of compulsory education in this country, we have thought of the government as having some right to educate children so that they become active, productive participants in the larger society, she says. This involves, in part, giving children the knowledge to eventually get jobs and support themselves. It's also important that children grow up exposed to community values, social values, democratic values, ideas about non-discrimination, and tolerance of other people's viewpoints, she says. Continuing on, whoops, That last one was totally an argument against going to college. Just kidding. She's completely unaware of all her own hypocrisy. So that's picking up from tolerance of other people's viewpoints. She says, noting that European countries such as Germany ban homeschooling entirely, and that countries such as France require home visits and annual tests. In the United States, Bartlett says, state legislators have been hesitant to restrict the practice because of the Homeschooling Legal Defense Association, a conservative Christian homeschool advocacy group, which she describes as small, well-organized, and, quote, overwhelmingly politically powerful, unquote. During the last 30 years, activists have worked to dismantle many states' homeschooling restrictions and have opposed new regulatory efforts. There's really no organized political opposition, so they basically get their way, Bartlett says. A central tenet of this lobby is that parents have absolute rights that prevent the state from intervening to try and safeguard the child's right to education and protection. Bartlett maintains that parents should have, quote, very significant rights to raise their children with the beliefs and religious convictions that the parents hold. But requiring children to attend schools outside of the home for 6 or 7 hours a day, she argues, does not unduly limit parents' influence on a child's views and ideas. The issue is, do we think that parents should have 24/7, essentially authoritarian control over their children from ages 0 to 18? I think that's dangerous, Bartlett says. I think it's always dangerous to put powerful people in charge of the powerless and to give the powerful ones total authority, she continued, alarmingly unaware of the astonishing levels of self-parody she had just reached. She concedes that in some situations, homeschooling may be justified and effective. Quote, no doubt there are some parents who are motivated and capable of giving an education that's of a higher quality and as broad in scope as what's happening in the public school, she says. But Bartlett believes that parents want permission to opt out of schools. The burden of proving that their case is justified should fall on parents. Quote, I think an overwhelming majority of legislators and American people, if they looked at the situation, Bartlett says, would conclude that something ought to be done. So in today's conversation, Corey and I will begin to respond. On Wednesday's conversation, I will open the show taking a closer look at how the ideas of people like Bartlett trickle down into media and public opinion. We'll go back to that NPR discussion that I played at the beginning of the show. It was from a January episode called How Should We Regulate Homeschooling? We're beyond ifs, everybody. Let's get to the hows. I found that NPR show because I was looking for information on some of the presenters at this Harvard anti-homeschooling conference. And why don't I just tell you who they are before we get to the first part of my conversation with Corey? So this is from HSLDA's website. That is the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And obviously we here at School Sucks are much more in alignment with them than we are with the people they're about to criticize. But it is worth pointing out that this is, you know, seeing these people through their lens. So with that point of view pointed out, these are their summaries. Dr. Rachel Coleman, founder of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education and co-founder of Homeschooling's Invisible Children, she's expected to reiterate her organization's views that homeschooling must be more firmly regulated by the government. Proposed regulations include a call for annual evaluation of every homeschooled student. Samantha Field, author of Meet HSLDA, the most powerful religious right lobby you've never heard of. The article starts by declaring the Homeschool Legal Defense Association has fomented a culture of suspicion and wild conspiracy theories that may put children in danger. I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at Samantha. I'm laughing at my own imagination as it conjures up the avatar of the culture of suspicion. And it's like a dad in overalls and he's kind of like shuffling down his driveway with a shotgun because there's a truck, you know, unloading something by his mailbox. And the kids are all like, it's okay, daddy. It's just another delivery of chickpeas for the bomb shelter. Stupid culture of suspicion, bean hoarding hicks. Carmen Longoria Green, litigation counsel for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Green's 2015 note for the Georgetown Law Review describes the current homeschool environment as, quote, massively deregulated, and suggests that states should set up a process where homeschooled students could petition a judge to force their parents to send them to public school. Such a process is necessary, she told the Washington Post, because, quote, it's unreasonable to expect children to be their own advocates. You need a forum where an outside person looks at the situation and says, is this person meeting educational outcomes? Because, you know, education is very outcomes based. Dr. Chelsea McCracken, who asserted in 2018 that, quote, research on homeschooled students' academic performance has been hampered by the lack of data collected on homeschool students in most states. And last one I'm going to tell you about is Dr. James Dwyer, law professor at the College of William and Mary. He is the professor famous for claiming that, and this is a direct quote, so this is not slant. Quote, oh, you know what? I'm going to have Jim tell you himself.
The state needs to be the ultimate guarantor of a child's well-being. There's just no alternative to that. The reason parent-child relationships exist is because the state confers legal parenthood on people through its paternity and maternity laws. It's the state that is empowering parents to do anything with children, to take them home, to have custody, and to make any kind of decisions about that.
And finally, the summit is being organized by Dwyer and Professor Elizabeth Barthollet. In Barthollet's recent article in the Arizona Law Review, she recommends a presumptive ban on homeschooling with the burden on parents to demonstrate justification for permission to homeschool. So today, Corey and I will discuss the bigger picture and the Harvard Magazine article in part two coming on Wednesday. We will dig into that actual so-called academic paper and look at some of the unchecked premises that exist there. We will also talk about, and I'll tell you now so you can mark your calendars, the Harvard Kennedy School has actually organized a kind of counter event called the Disinformation Campaign Against Homeschooling. It's happening this Friday. This is why I decided to make it Harvard Week. This is the description from Harvard's event page. Speakers will discuss the dishonest attacks on homeschooling that have been pervasive in the media and academia, and also address the failures of public education. So this is, again, very much a response to what is going to be taking place at Harvard Law this June. I'm going to put a direct link to this Zoom meeting in the show notes for today's episode. Speakers include five previous School Sucks guests: Kevin Soling, who was the director of the War on Kids; Carrie McDonald, who was my guest like 2 weeks ago; Pat Ferenga, who was on the show last year to discuss unschooling; Peter Gray, who was on the show in 2018 to discuss self-directed learning; and Corey DeAngelis, who's going to be on this show less than 1 minute from now. Here we go.
But when you leave,
wasn't the first thing that I wanted to talk about, but here we are. I see that you've been on top of this issue. Everybody who's listening already knows what we're talking about. The timing is interesting, but I have been watching your response and numerous other people's response over the last week at this point to this anti-homeschooling article in the Harvard Magazine, and it actually relates to a much longer academic paper written by a Harvard law professor. How did you encounter this? And what was it? Were you surprised to see this development?
Well, calling it an academic paper is a little bit too generous.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
It's pretty anti-intellectual when we get into the details, and we'll go over that. And a lot of the audience probably understands why I say that. But I first saw it through a Harvard Magazine article on the risks of homeschooling, where it's essentially a huge fear-mongering article against homeschooling. And, you know, they argue that homeschooling could lead to educational malpractice and potential child abuse. And it's completely one-sided in that it never compares any of the rates of these rare events to the occurrences in government-run schools, which are the realistic alternative to homeschooling. And so a lot of this work and a lot of the backlash, I believe, is because it's so unscientific and that it essentially makes perfect the enemy of the good. and doesn't compare differences in rates of abuse between sectors and differences in the outcomes between sectors. And I think the reason that these articles do not contend with that evidence is because it's overwhelmingly in favor of homeschooling, that homeschool kids generally get better academic results and even social results. And rates of child abuse, if you look at the literature on that, tends either not to differ between the sectors, or actually there could be actually higher rates of child abuse, according to some sources in the government school sector. And it's probably because parents generally care about their children more than, you know, employees of the government school system.
Well said. Had you ever heard of this professor, Elizabeth Barthollet, before this article?
No, I hadn't heard of her before, but she had actually given a talk at the Cato Institute on a different topic. I was not present at that conference, and haven't even looked into it much before. But this is one of her biggest, you know, articles that I've seen on homeschooling, and it came out in that law review peer-reviewed journal this year in 2020. So I think her homeschooling work is pretty recent. But yes, I mean, I haven't really paid attention to her work on any other subjects until I saw this Harvard Magazine article, which is just completely ridiculous, filled with fear-mongering and not really taking a rigorous intellectual, having an intellectual discussion about, you know, differences between sectors. And I think that's the main problem.
Sure. Okay. So I wanted to try. I mean, she made it very difficult, but I wanted to try to give her a fair hearing. I watched a couple interviews with her on separate subjects. She is not very enjoyable to listen to. In fact, Elizabeth Warren might be unseated as Harvard's least enjoyable Elizabeth. I looked at her, like her page at harvard.edu. My background was working in boarding schools. We took in lots of kids who had been in foster care, broken home, abusive situations, all of that. And, you know, I see the things that she's worked on throughout her career. So there's a lot of overlap, like things we would, even though we would come at it totally differently as far as like philosophy or policy is concerned, a lot of her interests as far as child welfare do seem to align with mine. And another thing that's worth pointing out is that she is not a young woman. This is not somebody who just like went through some kind of social sciences program and turned around, you know, to become a college professor, or worse yet, something that has been happening a lot, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, these people go and they work in the lower levels of education. But, you know, she looks like she's been at it since the 1960s or the 1970s. I just wanted to tell people a little bit just from her bio here on the website. She's the Morris Wasserstein Public Interest Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Child Advocacy Program, which she founded in 2004. She teaches civil rights and family law, specializing in child welfare, adoption, and reproductive technology. Before joining Harvard, she was engaged in civil rights and public interest work, first with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and later as a founder and director of the Legal Action Center, a nonprofit organization in New York City focused on criminal justice and substance abuse issues. So I think, you know, I was saying to you right before we started that if you just Google the title of the article that was in Harvard Magazine plus Harvard, you're 3 pages into Google results before you. I went through 3 pages. I still didn't see anything treating this original article positively.
Well, it's completely unscientific, and that's not the only problem. It's not just her analysis. It's also her policy recommendations. She calls for a presumptive ban on the practice of homeschooling because of all these potential things that might happen. And it's weird that she doesn't realize that if she applied her same logic to the government school system and just applied it to the educational system writ large, that if anything, if we applied our own logic to the education system, we would have a presumptive ban on government schooling, not a presumptive ban on homeschooling. So I think that's another reason for all the pushback. It's not just that she has negative views about homeschooling and that she's producing shoddy research and unscientific research on the topic. It's also that she's coming after our right to educate our own children at home with this presumptive ban on the practice.
Why do you think this seems to be coming more common with these academics, this upper level in the cathedral that sort of disseminate thought down, even though it didn't seem to be super successful considering all the pushback that this particular article has gotten? But lots of ideas are disseminated from people like this to the rest of a sort of uncritical media, and then eventually it translates into being public opinion. Yeah. Do you feel like just in observing this over the last 5 or 10 years that these people have become dramatically lazier, or do you think this is just par for the course?
Well, I don't know of the trend over time, but I know there's a couple of reasons why these views could be held. One is that, you know, they're elite academics at Ivy League institutions and other institutions, and they think that they're much smarter than everybody else. And I think they have a negative view about people who don't agree with them. As you can see in the Harvard Magazine article, there's a lot of jabs at Christians and conservatives. And I'm not a religious person myself, but it seems weird to attack people's First Amendment right to freely exercise their religion. But then also, it seems to be that enemies of homeschooling, and then also enemies of school choice, you know, being able to pick a private school or a charter school of your choice, a lot of the sentiment is the same, that it's almost like they believe that low-income families aren't smart enough or just don't have the wisdom that they have to be able to educate their own children at home, or even to just be able to pick some type of private or public school for their own children. And it's also a weird idea, and I don't have a great explanation for this, that government employees are somehow angelic and that they have no faults of their own, and that they are, you know, as all government employees are all as smart as these Harvard professors. It's again making perfect the enemy of the good and not grappling with the realistic policy alternative, which is government schools, which again has a lot of abuse and educational maltreatment itself.
Do you think, one of the reasons why I brought up all the negative Google results about this is I wanted to balance that with her record to say, okay, look, this is at least a legit person who is coming from, I think, a place of concern versus mm-hmm. Some of the treatment that you would see is if kids are homeschooled, they can't be indoctrinated by professors like this. I think at this point, is that true? Yeah, sure. But by and large, is that true? Yes. But she has a longer track record of expressing this kind of concern. But when it comes to this article, it does read, whether you're talking about the synopsis of it in Harvard Magazine, or if we go, and I think we will in this conversation, dig into her 80-page paper that the magazine references, it's almost written with the same kind of thoughtfulness as something you would see on Slate or Salon or the Huffington Post.
Well, and this is an academic, quote unquote, peer-reviewed journal article. And that just goes to show again that academic peer review isn't all about academic rigor. It's a lot of the time it's about getting a peer reviewer who agrees with your preconceived notions, who will blindly, because academic peer review is double blind, the reviewer, no one can tell who the reviewers are, and they can pass it through the process and accept the article, even if it's not any good. And they won't ever be held accountable for that, because peer review in the academic sense, again, quote unquote academic sense, is blind. And I think that's one of the big problems of peer review. But you're right. I mean, there are some ridiculous quotes in there. There's not a lot of rigor. It's pretty similar to the Harvard Magazine article. And I think at one point in the article, she even outright says that many families are not capable of educating their own children at home. And that might be a paraphrase, or I might have got it completely right, but that's the sentiment of the piece. I know the words many parents are not capable were used in that longer form article.
Well, I had Carrie McDonald on my show a couple of weeks ago, and I started out just infuriating myself by reading parts of a Salon article that I think Carrie actually responded to. And that same statement was in there, which has some truth in it. Certainly, there are families that at this point are not capable of doing this, especially after there's such an accepted outsourcing of this responsibility to the state. And obviously, people are in economic situations or family dynamics that don't allow for this right now, but that doesn't get packaged up as an effective argument against the whole endeavor of home education. And, just the other reason why I asked you about, do you think this has gotten worse in the last 5 or 10 years? Certainly, we've seen in higher education a resistance to debate, a resistance to diversity of ideas. This obviously is spilled into all forms of social media. And obviously, yeah, I'm not surprised to see that in the Salon article that I mentioned, or even in the Harvard Magazine article that I mentioned. But when I went to the long form paper and started reading through that, I mean, it's effectively like a signed confession that she's never had a conversation with anyone she disagrees with about this. There are brief references to diversity in homeschooling, that it is not, that not everybody homeschooling is one of these right-wing fundamentalist Christian lunatics. But then where does she shine the spotlight as far as like in generating like a fearful response to the current state of homeschooling? All of her attention goes there. It's like filming a scene in a movie. And this is true with like how any sort of historical or political narrative is told. You can take the same actors, the same set with the same script, and you can create a million different outcomes based on where you put the cameras and where you shine the lights, mm-hmm. and what you hide in the shadows. And she's just very, very effective, like getting that out of the way, that she acknowledges that there's, okay, there's some diversity, but let's really, really laser in and only talk about the crazy Christian conservatives that are really like the backbone of this movement.
Well, I mean, it's like the definition of a propaganda hit piece. I mean, it shouldn't be in a peer-reviewed academic journal if that journal wants to be seen as intellectually rigorous and academic in the true sense of the word. Any academic article should compare differences in rates of abuse and differences between sectors, especially when you're calling for a presumptive ban on one of these sectors. You have to be able to compare the rates of these instances between the two sectors. But the thing is, I mean, if she did that, she would have to call for a presumptive ban on government schooling. And I don't think she wants to do that. I mean, also, we hinted a little bit that, I mean, maybe she has the best interest of children in mind, but she's forgetting the realistic policy implications of her recommended policy to have a presumptive ban on homeschooling. And, you know, a lot of her arguments also centered around the idea that, well, there is some, you know, proportion, although she doesn't give very many hard statistics, of parents who might abuse their children and use homeschooling as an outlet to avoid, you know, some type of detection from the government school system. But I just tweeted out earlier, but what if the abusers are more likely to be in the government schools, whether that's a child, you know, other students abusing your child, or the government school teachers and other employees in the school system who are abusing the children? That can occur as well. And the evidence has shown that there's either no difference or this could be more likely to happen in the government school system. And again, I mean, if you apply this logic, you know, that there are mandated reporters in the government school system, if that's a legitimate justification for a ban on homeschooling, then why don't we start at birth? Are these people really arguing to hand our kids over to government institutions right when they're born? If it's really important and if the benefits outweigh the costs, then why don't we start at the age of zero? Why do we start at the age of five is one of my responses to that. But then also, I mean, government school employees aren't perfect. And, you know, imagine if we did this for other aspects of our lives, such as food, for example. Would we say that, you know, it's justified to have a government employee come to 100% of families' households every day or every week?
Every meal. What are you having for dinner?
Yeah, we not even just checking the fridge. You got to watch the meat, you know, to make sure they're eating quote unquote healthy food. And if you look at the food pyramid, the government doesn't get that right either.
Yeah.
And I mean, I use the analogy of why not start at birth, but we can even extend the analogy even further to, well, I mean, there is a legitimate, you know, case to be made that, or it's true that there is some number of couples that are in an abusive relationship. Does that mean that we need to mandate that 100% of couples go see a government counselor every day or every week to make sure that there's some type of mandatory reporter? I think that would be a huge restriction of liberty that would be ridiculous. And it's essentially what that would mean is that we're all guilty until proven innocent. And that's completely backwards of how we should do things and how we actually do things in America.
Indeed. What was the term that she used as far as like child protection was concerned, that teachers are mandated reporters?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments made in, I believe it's in the Harvard Magazine and her longer form piece, that there are mandated reporters of abuse. You know, if a kid comes to a teacher and says, my parents are abusing me, then in theory, the government school employees are supposed to report this to CPS.
Right.
But again, I mean, what if the teachers are the ones that are engaging in the abuse? I mean, you have the 2004 report from the U.S. Department of Education finding that 1 in 10 kids going through the government school system will experience sexual misconduct by the government school employees themselves by the time they graduate from high school. And I mean, that could be a lower bound of the true estimate because, you know, there's also another report finding that government school teachers tend to pass through 3 different school districts before they actually get reported for engaging in this type of misconduct. So a lot of that gets unreported as well. So where are the mandatory reporters for the government school teachers that are engaging in this type of misconduct?
Right. And that's just adult to child. What about child to child? What about peer to peer? Our teachers, and that was why the mandated reporters thing stuck out to me, is like, if you look at how much negative social interaction that might just exist below the threshold of physical abuse. And obviously, like, yeah, in the home, and I've seen this, like, I remember being in elementary school and hearing talk of this and in middle school as well, and actually hearing my peers tell teachers, this is what's happening in my home. And then, yes, there was some kind of intervention, but there was nothing for like peer-to-peer negative interaction, and everything that doesn't rise to the level of physical abuse. Even though there were all these efforts to kind of stamp out bullying by turning up the authoritarian controls of the teachers and administrators in the school. I mean, this is something we were talking about on my show like 7 or 8 years ago. And when I was an academic service provider, we had to sit through webinars on this subject of like how to, respond to bullying. But what's changed? You know, what's changed since all those campaigns 7 or 8 years ago? So the mandated, I just saw it. The reason why I'm digging into this so much is when I read the Harvard article and then I read the paper and I saw that term, it's back to filming that scene the way you want, in a way that is like really deceptive as far as realism is concerned, right? It's turning all of the stuff that goes on in school into total darkness. And again, assuming that benevolence of state institutions and government actors.
I mean, it's completely ridiculous to assume benevolence because we have real hard data on the fact that there's a lot of bad things going on in government schools today. I mean, I just cited that 2004 report, which is old, but that's just because that's the most recent data we have on that particular subject. But the U.S. Department of Education in 2018, super recent, released a report on school indicators of crime. And in 2018, they reported data from the most recent school year, the 2015-2016 school year, and they found that 79% of government schools reported some type of violent crime incidents occurring in that most recent school year, and about 1 in every 5 children reported having some form of bullying in that most recent school year. So it's not it's one thing to assume that there's benevolence without any data to back that up, but there is data that directly contradict that assumption of benevolence of the government school system. And so it's completely, again, and I've said this so many times, but it's completely unscientific, and it's really shameful that a quote unquote academic journal article published this type of analysis.
Absolutely. So let's again, we'll probably circle back into this at some point because there's lots more that we can get into. But I just wanted to back out to the bigger picture of this journal article in the Arizona Law Review was published 2019. So obviously, this whole thing is not a response to the current coronavirus crisis where everybody is suddenly being homeschooled, right? And I don't think there was any assumption, or there couldn't have been any imagining in 2019 that would be the case in the spring of 2020. So this was a project this professor worked on probably throughout a good portion of 2019. And I know because you've been on top of this since the Harvard Magazine story came out And we also learned, and we'll get to this as well, that there's a subsequent summit that's going to take place at Harvard University that is going to ask some questions about, you know, the safety and effectiveness of homeschooling. But do you have any idea what the intention behind this was? Why Professor Bartholet suddenly took this turn in like away from child, or, you know, I mean, she would see it as a necessary transition in her child welfare work.
I think she sees herself as you know, protecting children from these darn uneducated parents, and take, you know, using her presumptive ban to, in her view, protect those children and to get them into these benevolent and all powerful and all knowing government schools. I think she probably has good intentions behind that, and that's probably why she's, you know, launch this conference. But I mean, the slant of the conference is obvious, and it's explicitly described in their own event description on the Harvard website, saying that the focus of the event will be on educational maltreatment and child abuse that happens under the guise, they say, of homeschooling. So it's an explicitly anti-homeschooling conference. You look at the list of speakers. I mean, I didn't see any pro-homeschooling speakers on the agenda. I wasn't invited to even be a participant. Carrie McDonald, who was on your podcast before, wasn't invited. I'm sure, Brett, you weren't invited either. No one that I know who supports homeschooling has been invited. And I have a pretty big network of people in the homeschooling movement and also the school choice movement. No one that I know has been invited that is on my side in the issue to this conference. And it's, you know, it's one thing not to allow us to speak and to, you know, engage in the ideas as a speaker, but it's another thing to also make it a private event and completely block off anyone from even hearing the views or even getting any chance of voicing their opinions as an audience member as well. And so that's, you know, it's completely closed off. And that's, I think that's another reason for a lot of the pushback from people.
Indeed. So what is that conference called, the initial conference that Harvard is putting together?
I've just been referring it to it as the anti-homeschooling conference by
right,
Harvard
yeah.
Law School. I know the name of our response conference.
Yes.
The disinformation campaign against homeschooling. And this one's set up by the Harvard Kennedy School. And we're doing that on Friday, May 1st. And I'm one of the speakers, Carrie McDonald, who was on your show is also one of the invited speakers as well. And we have Peter Gray and a couple of other speakers as well to make the case counter to the anti-homeschooling conference, to, you know, take a more scientific approach and showing the differences in education levels between sectors and the differences in abuse between sectors and the difference in violence between sectors. Instead of just focusing on one sector, I believe we're taking the more scientific and more intellectually honest approach of you know, grappling with the actual data on what's going on and showing the case that, you know, the homeschoolers actually tend to be better off academically and socially, and they get to avoid a lot of that negative socialization that too often occurs at government schools, just such as the bullying, the fighting, the engagement in gang activities, the indoctrination in the classroom. You know, the violence that occurs at government schools, the drugs. So we're just giving another side to the conversation. And one of the main differences of our conference is, well, one, it's virtual. So that's obviously a main difference because we're being responsible during the coronavirus shutdowns, but then also it's open to the public. And we have a Facebook event group. And when I checked it this morning, even though it was just created yesterday, I think we already have about 1,000 people who have RSVP'd. And so look, you know, we believe that we have the better ideas, and we believe that letting everyone see these ideas is a good thing, not a bad thing. There's no reason to close off good ideas. If, you know, put the sunlight on the ideas and see who's right.
So do you have any hope with all the work you do on things like school choice? And do you have any hope at this point that the people who are going to be like organizing or attending this first Harvard conference, the anti-homeschooling conference, would ever want to mix it up or exchange ideas with somebody like you or Carrie McDonald or Pat Ferenga?
Well, I've tagged Harvard in two tweets since yesterday. I think, yeah, both these tweets I sent out were yesterday saying, hey, Harvard, well, after this, you know, we have our, you have your anti-homeschooling conference. We got the response conference, but hey, let's settle this once and for all and have a debate with the speakers from both conferences. Let's have, you know, Elizabeth Barthollet and her co-organizer, James Dwyer, who essentially said that your kids belong to the government. I don't know if you saw the viral video of him saying that the only reason that parent-child relationships exist at all is because the government allows you to be a parent. So, I mean, why not have a debate of ideas and an exchange of ideas, you know, a professional in a professional setting at Harvard, and have their speakers go up against our speakers? You know, I think we would win that debate. And I think Harvard should have that debate. And I think Harvard should ask, you know, the law school, you know, someone at Harvard should ask the law school and to ask Elizabeth Barthollet if she would be willing to engage in a free-flowing exchange of ideas.
I totally agree that, somebody should do that.
I don't think they want to do that. I mean, they made their conference invitation only in private. I mean, they started all this. And from that, and then, you know, yeah, just seeing that, it seems like they probably wouldn't want to because they really don't have the facts on their side. They don't have the scientific evidence on their side. And, you know, I would feel bad almost arguing against them because they just don't have any rigorous evidence on their side. And it would be a really tough case for them to make to restrict our liberties and to have a presumptive ban on homeschooling and to take away our right to educate our own children at home. That's a really tough case for them to make. They shouldn't have even made it in the first place. But you know, if they are confident in their ideas, they should be willing to let every member of the public be able to view their ideas at their conference. They should change that rule that they have, that it's invite only. And they should also be more than willing to debate the ideas with, you know, me and some of the other people like Peter Gray and Carrie McDonald on stage in person after the lockdown ends. If, you know, if they're confident, they should be able to do that.
Well, you know, debating people who disagree with you is kind of a way of just like slowing things down. It's like people who want to debate you just want to get in the way of the serious progressive work that you need to get done. And it's best to just tell them you don't have time to justify their objections.
Well, another thing is, I think a lot of, and this isn't a jab at all professors. It's, you know, not all professors are like this. I just want to say that. But a lot of times, you know, if you're a university professor, I think a lot of people get used to having students who don't push back all that much. Same thing with, you know, K-12 educators. The students essentially just want to get a good grade. And so they essentially just agree with everything the professor says.
Oh my God, where would they have learned to do otherwise?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's way more difficult to argue with other professionals in the field than it is to argue, you know, than it is to argue with a bunch of 18-year-olds who are relying on you to give them an A, because all they really want is an A so they can get that 4.0 on their transcripts so that they can hopefully get a good job with that piece of paper, with that diploma after they exit college. So I mean, it's a completely different ball game when you actually have to debate your ideas, and again, even outside of the journals, a lot of times the journals. A lot of people don't read the journal articles. You just have your peer reviewers who already agree with you, accept it, and then they publish it in the journals. And then most people don't read those long form articles. I mean, a lot of people didn't see this until the Harvard Magazine article came out. And so that's where all the pushback comes from. When the public actually starts to engage in these ideas, I think it's a lot more difficult. And I think a lot of academics don't want to, you know, have to go under that type of scrutiny.
You also mentioned to me before we started that you do a podcast. Have you been able to like engage in any debate there? I ask because, like, you know, we're talking about these people as like this routine of mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all. I mean, that's kind of what a lot of college professors are doing with their students. And I've even seen like a lot of firsthand evidence and a lot of anecdotal evidence from people who've like called into my show or sent me mail through the years that There is a major resistance to even challenging what is being presented in a lot of these classes. And maybe that has started to extend. I mean, I think just from a discipline standpoint, that extends into the lower level of schools, but it's more ideological in higher education where kids are, or young adults are shamed for, you know, challenging professors or expressing different views. But, you know, here I'm in a situation where today I'm interviewing you. You know, a couple weeks ago, I'm interviewing Carrie. Like, that's pretty much what we do here. And I would love to be able to, you know, mix it up with people who had differing opinions, but they're very, very hard to, like, you know, get them to agree to do something like this. And I don't know if you had better luck with anything that you've tried to put out there, podcasting or otherwise.
I will say that we just started our EFI podcast, but we've already done 10, I think about 10 episodes. So we're moving pretty quickly. And I will say it has been a lot of people that we like on our show, but that, you know, there could be different outlets, you know, for debate. I mean, we could start using podcasts as a form of debate, but I mean, just a couple of other experiences that I've had with trying to set up in-person debates. I think that's the best way to do a debate, to actually have a big event, you know, in person at a university.
Sure.
I was planned to do a debate on school choice at the University of Memphis just a month or two ago, before the shutdown occurred. From what I could tell, what I heard was about three professors, law professors, declined to debate me. And, you know, they were supposed to take the anti-school choice side. And, you know, maybe all three of those people just by coincidence, you know, were busy or had some other things to do. But it seems like, you know, a lot of people don't want to engage in these types of debates. And also, I was scheduled to do a debate with the dean of the University of Kentucky. His name is Julian Vasquez Heilig, and we vehemently disagree on school choice. And we were scheduled for a debate. He was actually the first person to say yes to the debate and to solidify a date. And they hadn't had the other person yet. But then the organizer of the debate said, "Oh, well, Corey DeAngelis, you know, is pretty much a big school choice guy." He didn't tell, you know, Julian this yet, but he asked me to participate in the debate, and I said, "Heck yeah, I'll debate Julian. That sounds like a great idea." And then the very day, or the next day after I said yes, it turns out that Julian Vasquez Heilig dropped out of the debate after he figured out that I was the debate opponent. So you know, maybe there was something that came up, but I mean, he already committed to that day. And I was open to any day. We could have switched the day. The organizer was open to switching the day. But for whatever reason, this opponent, the dean at the University of Kentucky, who I don't think is very good at debating his ideas, and I don't think he has the evidence on his side, chose to back out. And so, I mean, this has happened a lot of times.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that as attractive as it is to try and, you know, change hearts and minds at that level, what is probably more important to do, especially right now where we're not even sure if kids are going back to school, you know, I mean, it's not happening this year, but is it going to happen in the fall? We don't know. So obviously, a lot of people have become instant homeschoolers, and I've objected to that on my show because what they're doing is basically conditional forced distance learning.
It's the worst form of homeschooling possible. So if people like this, just imagine how much they would like real homeschooling, right?
Oh, exactly. And I think that actually, when we're talking about the negative social dynamics and how Professor Bartholet wants to prevent them by, you know, outbanning homeschooling because some parents are possibly abusers or murderers. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of compare that to some of the things that are going on in the school. How about how the home translates, or excuse me, the school translates to the home? You know, in that, like when I did work as an academic service provider, so I was a tutor, I did SAT. When I started, I only wanted to do like college consulting and standardized test stuff as I went on in that career. This was many, many years ago, but the first thing that I started to turn away from was academic tutoring. Like, I'm here, Jeffrey, because you have a C.
We got to get your grades up.
I didn't like that because I felt like an enforcer for the school. But how is every parent made to feel? Now, I know some parents do go to bat for their kids when there are problems at school. But I think the default that I observed, especially in these more, competitive, I worked in like the greater Boston area, Needham, Massachusetts. Parents basically become police for the school, right? The school is something that interrupts the quality of family life. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. Kids are being shaken to get out of bed. You got to go to bed. You got to do your homework. I remember counseling parents about this who were in tears about things that that were happening in a high school or a middle school. And eventually their resignation was just, well, we got to do what the teacher says, or we have to do what the principal says, and that's the way it has to be. And then they have to enforce that on their children. So that's another huge negative social consequence of school. But yeah, there might be a lot of parents right now who, even if they aren't enjoying this whatever, this forced distance learning where the schools are still dictating what kids have to do every day, one of the things that I'm learning is what used to take between get up, get ready, get on a bus, go to school, come home on a bus, do an extracurricular, do your homework, 10 hours a day.
What a waste.
You know, is now 4 hours a day, right?
Yes.
50 hours a week has been more than cut in half. And I think that thoughtful parents are going to have to observe that their children are happier and feeling more free and having more time to pursue, you know, their own intrinsically motivated interests. And that could be, a wonderful change, getting parents more involved. There's obviously going to be all kinds of negative consequences in higher education. We just talked about this on my show earlier this week, where a friend of mine told me that there were college professors talking openly on Twitter about how they were quite anxious about having to post their full syllabi online, because parents would be able to see what's being taught.
Yep.
Right?
So, a whole lot of nothing.
Indoctrination. I think that my friend said that one of the professors was particularly concerned with a course called The Toxicity of Whiteness. The Toxicity of Whiteness. These are the kinds of things that there's obviously numerous examples of things like that going on in higher education, but also in the lower levels of school where parents are going to become more watchful, more involved, and they're going to say, hey, wait a minute. First of all, in the midst of the worst crisis that any of us have ever dealt with in our lives, somehow I've got happier children, right? I've got, I know that sounds like a little bit hyperbolic, but I really do believe, and I'm starting to get at least anecdotal evidence that backs this up, that kids, given more of their own time and control over their lives and not having to adhere to that school schedule that, you know, goes against their natural circadian rhythms. Mm-hmm. Like, there are lots of benefits emotionally for young people, whether we're talking about elementary age or all the way up to college age. And this, I think, has the potential to at least cause a lot of questioning about the status quo in the schooling system at all levels.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. That's one of the almost silver linings of the coronavirus pandemic, is that a lot of people have this chance to take a step back and look at the factory model school system that we have today and question whether that's really how we should structure education and whether we could actually do it better by educating our children at home. And I will say, I've also seen a ton of anecdotal evidence of parents on social media and otherwise just, again, saying that their kids are feeling less anxious, they're feeling less stressed, they're feeling happier, they're learning the same material or even more material in a lot less time than they were when they were going to the schools. And they're doing it a lot less of a cost, essentially, because they're essentially doing it for free. Why are we pouring so much money into the government school system when it's actually doing more harm than good? Doesn't make any sense to me. We spend over $15,000 per child per year in government schools in the United States. What a complete waste, especially if it's doing less of a good job than when parents actually have the ability to educate their own children at home. And I will say that until a couple of days ago, this has really just been that, a bunch of anecdotes where parents were saying, good things, and there were other parents saying bad things, and you had articles and opinion pieces in the Washington Post saying that you know, teachers should be paid $1 billion a year because this is so hard, and that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the Salon article with the negative views. But there's actually been a nationally representative survey that came out a couple of days ago by EdChoice, and they asked parents on one of the questions, what are your views of homeschooling as a result? How have they changed as a result of COVID-19? And the numbers, this is, you know, hard scientific numbers, a legitimate study of a nationally representative sample of parents in the United States found that 52% reported that they were more favorable of homeschooling, or whatever version of homeschooling this actually is. A lot of people don't like to call it homeschooling, but whatever right. this is, their views of homeschooling and what they see as, you know, what's happening now, is 52% say they're more favorable of homeschooling, and less, and half of that proportion say that they're less favorable. Only 26% reported that they were less favorable of as a result of COVID-19. And 22% said no difference. But the big takeaway is here is that, yeah, there have been anecdotes on both sides, but the hard data suggests that people actually are, on the, in the most part, they're more likely to support homeschooling as a result of COVID-19. And I think this is why the establishment and the monopolists of the government school system are freaking out right now, and they're attacking homeschooling in opinion pieces at Salon and Washington Post and elsewhere, is because, you know, a lot of people are figuring out that homeschooling works out really well, even if it's just this weird version of homeschooling that's not all that it could be.
Right.
But then even if these data didn't come out from EdChoice showing, you know, most were positive, let's imagine that study wasn't, you know, legitimate for whatever reason. I believe the findings, you know, they had a third party do the survey for them and everything. So it's an unbiased study of a nationally representative sample of parents. But let's just imagine that didn't exist. And let's imagine, you know, only 2% were more favorable, and only 2% of families decided to switch from government schooling to homeschooling as a result of this. That would still yeah. mean about 1 million fewer students in government schools. That's still a huge change. And as I've written at the Washington Examiner yesterday, I wrote an article called Why Government School Monopolists Are Freaking Out. And it's because there's no upside to COVID-19 for enemies of homeschooling. There's only a huge downside, or potential huge downside. They essentially have everything to lose and nothing to gain as far as the numbers are concerned, because the people who say they don't like homeschooling weren't homeschooling anyway. So, right. I mean, look, even if only 2% switch, that's still 1 million students. That's about $15 billion attached to those students every single year. And look, this is a huge threat to the government school monopoly today.
Did you see the article? I think it was like a PBS article, and it was actually from the Pennsylvania administrators.
Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators lobbied to block make it illegal to enroll in virtual charter schools. And the president of that organization, Mark DiRucco, actually admitted to a reporter that the reason that they opposed allowing kids to switch to virtual charter schools was because they were afraid of the competition, was because they said, oh, well, there might be some number of parents who figure out that virtual education is a good option right now, and we may lose a lot of money because of that. So they explicitly stated their intentions, which are that they're trying to prevent any money from leaving their system at the expense of students trying to get their, you know, a better education through virtual charter schools or otherwise. And I don't know if you saw this, but the Pennsylvania legislature and the governor signed a bill that, you know, that Mark DiRucco didn't get everything he wanted. The PASA, the Administrators Association, didn't get everything that they wanted, and that it's not illegal to switch to virtual schools at the moment during the shutdown, but they're not compensating any virtual charter schools for getting additional students during the shutdown. And they passed right. that in the legislature, which is you know, completely backwards yeah. of what you'd want to do. Yeah. Yeah. It's disincentivizing schools to serve students in the time of need. That's, I don't know why they did that. You know, it's probably has something to do with that lobbying by PASA trying to make it illegal, overall. And that, yeah, that's what they did in Oregon. They just made it completely illegal to enroll in virtual charter schools during the shutdown. So it's not that they're not, you know, Oregon took it a step further. It's not that the schools aren't being compensated. If you go to the website, Oregon Connections Academy, if any of the listeners want to fact check me right now, go to Oregon Connections Academy and try to go to enroll. You can't do it right now. It's illegal to do so.
And I pulled the, that article was on something called Why with two Y's.
Yep. It's like an NPR affiliate in Pennsylvania. Yeah.
So here's the paragraph. The president or the executive director of the Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators, obviously people very concerned with education. Districts across the state are concerned that if cyber charters are allowed to remain teaching and resume full operation while brick and mortar schools are closed, parents trying to find the least disruptive option for their children might be tempted to switch to cybers. So parents seeking the best possible solution for their own children who they love educationally is a problem for these educators. This would, again, just one more sentence, this would divert school funding away from districts as they try to quickly develop plans to address the potential need for long-term remote learning.
Ouch. It isn't only like an opposition to virtual schooling writ large, because the bill only applies this rule to virtual charter schools, not the virtual cyber school programs in the government-run schools in Pennsylvania. So as the bill is written today, and the bill that passed and was signed by the governor, you know, Tom Wolf, if a family, for whatever reason, moves from Camden, New Jersey to Pennsylvania, and if that family chooses, for whatever reason, a virtual charter school at this time, the charter school won't be compensated. But if they enroll their kid in a virtual cyber a government-run school at this time, they will be counted on their enrollments, and the government schools will be obviously compensated for that enrollment. So it's only applying to one sector, and it's just putting on full display that this is about protecting the government school system at the expense of parents.
In 1,000 years from now, when they find Jesus,